I'm Liz Guinness, and welcome to Talking Australia. Today I'm chatting with Brigitte Muir, one of my all-time adventure heroes. Brigitte was the first Australian woman to summit Everest and the first woman ever to climb the seven summits. Her take on the world is nothing short of extraordinary, and it's my complete pleasure to chat with her today. So sit back and enjoy the conversation. Thanks for joining Brigitte and I on this episode of Talking Australia. Obviously with Everest, there were four attempts at Everest. Maybe if you could just run us through why four, what was a series of kind of events at those different times that made that the case?
Yes, the first two times I went with John to the North Ridge of Everest. We were
sorry to interrupt just for a second, but I know that you said you and John obviously were married and then separated.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that. We got back together.
Yeah, because I'm thinking this is a really amicable separation.
No, we were back together by then.
Right, okay.
Yeah, after pondering on our lives and, decided to give it another go.
Some time apart. Mm-hmm.
That's right, yeah. John invited me to try again and I said yes. And so when was the first time I went there? 1993. We joined a group from out there trekking, a company belonging to some friends in England. Mm. That was the beauty of being in the business of climbing big mountains. We knew lots of people, and that meant that when I was looking for sponsorship, I could leave it to the last minute to join the trip, because it's always how sponsorship happens somehow. You know, you get it at the 11th hour and not before.
Yeah.
And that was easier, knowing that there was a space penciled for me or for us on the trip. So 1993, well, the weather was really, really bad and we didn't get very high. Camp 2, Camp 3, I think. Only two people on the trip went to the summit and back. That was Maciek Berbeka, who's an amazing Polish climber, who since died on the big mountain, unfortunately. And like Pashurpa, who was also an amazing climber and also died on another big mountain. High altitude climbing is very, very dangerous, unfortunately. So 1993, nothing happened as far as me getting to the summit. 1995, back to Tibet and Chomolungma. And in 1995, John got really sick at the last camp, at Camp 4, 8,000 something. And so we had to come down. It was just a question of knowing what was more important, getting to the summit or losing my husband. And there was,
No choice.
It was obvious what to do. And then I went back up after going back down to base camp with him. I went back up with the last group of our team to go for the summit. And I got to the last camp. Everybody was already there. And what happened was that I was more acclimatized than they were, because I'd already been there once before, but I didn't realize it. I didn't realize that their brains were not working quite well. We all set up. I was the last one to set up because I didn't have any oxygen cylinders, so I had to do a bit of rummaging and I was cooking for everybody. So anyway, they set off and I followed. And as we got close to the summit ridge at about 8,500 meters, my head torch stopped working. And it was quite a steep area and very old ropes, all shredded. So they were there more for mental comfort than anything else, really. Mm. So what happened was that because I was quite pissed off with those guys, because they'd left before.
And it was dark.
It was dark. Yes. No moon. They kept going and I was left behind basically trying to fix my head torch.
No.
Yes. And I ran out of oxygen and I couldn't go up or down because it was too dark. And so I had no choice but to go back down.
And obviously didn't want to rely on the ropes either, because
that's
they're
right,
old and
that's
torn.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. And I couldn't see anything. And they went on to the summit and came back to the last camp where I was. And I was devastated, as you can imagine, but I also realized that it was all my fault. You know, I was the one who had not communicated well with these guys. I should have said there was something wrong, but because I was pissed off at them, I didn't. And I almost died, of course, of hypothermia.
Yeah. But, well, yeah, exactly. But I read a quote from you that said that you think it was your anger at them that kind of kept you alive during that period of time.
Yeah. And trying to plan the next
day. The burning rage.
It worked well. Kept me alive.
So obviously then you headed back down and then that's by the end of that trip.
Yeah. So number three, I had enough of Tibet by then. So I went to Nepal the next time without John because climbing Everest from Nepal involved going through the ice fall, and as he had equipped the ice fall during the bicentennial expedition, he knew exactly what it was all about. It's a very, very dangerous place, and you don't want to spend more time than you're supposed to in that place.
So for people who don't know about it, what makes it so very dangerous?
The ice fall is the continuation of the Western Khum, which is where Camp 1 and Camp 2 are on the way to the Lhotse face, which then leads to Camp 4 on the South Col and the top of Everest. Now, it's like a frozen river. It goes over an edge and it's all broken down. You've got huge holes, you've got unstable fields of ice. It's basically, it moves all the time. And through that, you've got ladders over crevasses, going to the top of ice towers. And you have to really remember that any of those bits can collapse on top of you at any time.
So I've seen some video footage of, it looks like, I think it might have been you across one of the ladders with just nothing underneath. And you've got your crampons on, and it just looks so treacherous. That would be a feat in itself, just mentally getting yourself across one of those ladders, I would think.
Yeah. There was a fair bit of bleep, bleep, bleep in that video as well.
I think I did hear a few of those, actually.
Yeah, very scary. So John didn't
so I can
want
understand
to go
why
back
you
through.
Wouldn't want to spend any more time there. Yeah.
So I decided to go without him, which was totally fine because by that stage, you know, I've done enough mountaineering to trust my capabilities and my willingness to stay alive and turn back if needed, which I've never had any hesitation in doing. And so 96, well, guess what? 96 was a big tragedy on Everest. There was a big storm with two big teams on the South Col that went for the summit when they shouldn't, and were there too late in the day, got into trouble coming down because there was a storm every afternoon, clockwork. And so a lot of people died, and I was on the South Col when all that happened, and we did whatever we could with the very little information we had to help where we could, but it didn't stop eight people on our side to die.
And am I right in thinking that 11 people on the other side died as well?
There was 11 total,
11 total, right. Yeah, that's just, I don't know how that must feel to, and I imagine these are people that you knew or had met, and to know that was happening is just part of your community is gone.
Not at all, because those people were part of two expeditions that were the top of the range expeditions. There was an American one and a Kiwi one. And we basically had nothing to do with them. I was part of a shoestring expeditions led by Henry Todd, a friend of mine from England. And we, you know, we were there because we knew, or most of us knew what to do, how to look after ourselves on the mountain. And he was providing the infrastructure at base camp and the oxygen and all that, and, you know, a couple of Sherpas to carry this and that, but not much compared to the top of the range expeditions. So, no, I didn't know anyone in the people who died.
Okay. So even then, do you have a sense of if you can help, you should help? Or is it really kind of every man for himself when you're up at that altitude and you know what the consequences are if you get into trouble kind of thing? What is that sense when you're on the mountain?
I think it depends on who you are and why you're there. I know that we did what we could to help. In fact, you know, we offered to go up the mountain But we were told that it was all under control. I started helping Beck Weathers. I started helping him down the ropes with the group that was looking after him, and then I was told to bugger off. And I believe it's
by the group.
By the guides who were in charge of the operation. Not in those terms, of course. It was nicely said.
Of course.
But I wasn't putting anyone in danger, and I think I was helping him because I was right beside him coming down. But I don't know. I think there was something about a shoestring expedition helping an expensive expedition that didn't go down well. I don't know. There was lots of, you know, on big mountains, when you're talking about a lot of money, politics always comes into it.
Yeah.
But anyway, that was 96, so didn't get up that time. And of course, it was a time for reflection as well. Although we wanted to go back up the mountain, and some people did. There was an IMAX expedition there, and they did go back up and film their film, which became very famous after that. Mm. But anyway, that left me without Summit again. Went back the next year, 97. And this time, to make things interesting, our expedition leader died at base camp. I know, something always happens, doesn't it? Big mountains, they have a way to throw things at you.
Yes, they really challenge you and, you know, determination. That must have, I would imagine that would have really knocked the wind out of your sails.
It did and it didn't. Once again, commercial expedition, didn't know many people on the trip and hadn't really met Malduff, the guy who was leading the trip. So we had a big wake for him at base camp and we kept going with someone else in charge of the group. The weather was really bad though and pretty much everyone left the mountain. It was only towards the end that there was a tiny window of good weather. And by then there was practically no one left in my group. There was just one Mexican climber, Andres Delgado, and myself on the Everest team, and a few Sherpas, of course, who were still there. Okay. So we ended up climbing Everest right at the end of the season. Andres climbed it the day before I did, and we got there. I got there with Kipa Sherpa and Dorje Sherpa, who I think they decided to come with me because no Australian woman had climbed Everest.
Yeah.
And because all that happened, I had no idea who was going to come with me. It was like, you know, the Sherpas do what they want to do. They tell you exactly what's going to happen because they've decided.
Wow, you kind of feel like it would be the other way around, but that makes sense.
It does make sense. And it was the same leading expeditions, teaching people to climb afterwards. You let the Sherpas sort it out themselves. And even if you're the leader like I was, it's like, trust, delegate, they know what they're doing, and just put in your word if only it's needed. So anyway, we were the last one to climb the mountain that year, and it almost didn't happen because it snowed heavily the night we were on the South Col. Then it stopped snowing and we got out there at 1 o'clock in the morning in deep snow, really hard work, as you can imagine, hardly any ropes to go to the summit. And got to the summit eventually, which was really bizarre because I felt I was in a dream. I had this Hillary step that I'd seen so many times in book.
Yes.
In fact, I painted it as well. You know, I'd made a painting of the Hillary step. And there I was on the Hillary step. And then that slope that goes to the summit. It was very special. You know, thinking about it, that was the place where I was so happy to get to a summit and relieved as well because it had been long in the making, 9 years. When I started on the Seven Summit quest. I did make a mistake though, you know, in my excitement of being up there and filming and talking to my camera and thanking all the people who had helped me and also telling people to look after Australia because there's only one Australia.
I heard that.
It just came out.
And you're right. I felt very proud. I was like, yes, absolutely. We should.
So anyway, I had my oxygen mask off, and after an hour of you know, yippee yahoo on the summit, we had to come down, and I realized that taking my oxygen off for an hour on the top of the highest mountain on Earth hadn't been a good idea at all. I got pulmonary edema. I couldn't breathe. Unfortunately, my head wasn't affected, so after a while, I asked Kipa and Dodgy to find a bit of rope and to have me on a leash for the rest of the climb down to the South Col.
So is that a dangerous thing for both parties then? If you know, if someone slips and the other one is likely to go as well? So is that...
No, because when you're looking after someone who's not well, and I didn't slip or anything, but it could have happened, you put a very short rope between you and them so you can catch them straight away. If you had a long rope, you know, if you could have a swing or whatever. But yeah, that's why it's called a leash. It's really, you have someone on a leash. Yes, and then the next morning they went down, and I took my time coming down because I couldn't breathe and I couldn't lie down. And I ended up coming down on my own, and I was the last one on the mountain, and that was very, very special.
What was special about that to you?
There was no one around, and I had just finished my Seven Summit quest. So I was able to sit and really be in the moment and really, really appreciate the fact that it was done. It was relief. I wasn't happy or proud yet because I still had to go through the ice fall before getting back to base camp. But when I sat at Camp 2 in the Western Coombe with no one around, and I looked around, and it was just so beautiful and perfect, and I thought, wow, I'm never going to be back here again. And I didn't need to, because, you know, it was all there for me in a way, and I was just so grateful.
And to take and to be able to take that time to just, I guess, drink it all in and appreciate it and reflect.
That's right, on my own. I mean, you cannot even contemplate doing that these days. There's too many people.
No, that's exactly right. There's way too many people.
Yeah. So it was a precious moment.
Subscribe to our AG magazine for 6 months for just $30 and save 33% on the newsstand price. That's three issues of our award-winning magazine delivered to your home for just $30. Go to www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia for our special offer. That's www.australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia.
So you came back to Australia then, I'm assuming. And like so many, I've spoken to so many different adventurers, and they say that after achieving a monumentous goal like that, obviously there's the euphoria and the sense of achievement and having completed it, but then there's an emptiness that settles in on them because they don't know what they're doing next or quite how to adapt back to normal life where when they're not working towards a goal like that. Was that something that you struggled with as well, or wasn't the case?
I did later on, but not then, because basically life was dream of a mountain, make it happen, climb it, come back down, dream of another mountain. It was always about the next mountain. And for me, the next mountain was going to be Makalu. Makalu was a very special mountain because, first of all, it's beautiful. It also had history. John had lost his best friend, Mark Moorhead, in 1983. He fell down as he was on an expedition with Peter Hillary. And so it always had that sadness attached to it. And I wanted to make it a happy mountain again. And I wanted to climb an 8,000-meter peak without Sherpas and without oxygen. And it all fell into place. I joined a trip which was organised by Jeanette Harrison and Gary Fisterer. Jeanette Harrison being a super high-altitude climber from Britain and Gary from the States. And everything was going really well, you know. And I had a friend, Michael Jurgensen, who was supposed to climb with me. He was from Denmark. But somehow we didn't end up on the same expedition. And I met him on the mountain, but he was climbing with someone else, and so was I. I was climbing with another friend, Billy Pearson, from the States. And Billy and I were just about to go for the summit, having arrested base camp after carrying high on a mountain. Mm-hmm. And my friend Michael, who had been climbing with a member of our team, Markus Stoffer, a super climber from Germany, I think, or Austria, I can't remember. Anyway, they went for the summit, and Michael was killed coming back down. And that was the first time that I'd lost someone very close to me, because Michael had become a very good friend. We'd gone through the 96 South Gold debacle together.
Right.
And we'd become really close, basically, very good friends. And he died, and I couldn't even get back on the mountain. You know, I left everything there, and I went home.
Yeah.
And that was the end of my high-altitude climbing.
The end, full stop.
The end, full stop. That was
never
it.
Never to do it again.
No, what? It was too sad.
Wow. I mean, I can imagine it is, but to just put a full stop to that period of your life must have been... Yeah.
I had no choice. You know, I ended up going back to Kathmandu and meeting with Michael's parents and his sister and nephew. And it's very different when you're on the other side, when someone you love dies on the mountain. When it's someone you know, we were always saying, well, if someone dies in a car accident, you don't stop driving. But it's all very well and good. But when it's someone you love... who dies on a mountain, it's a completely different story. And in some ways, I think he saved my life, because, you know, so many people I know have died climbing on big mountains.
What do you do then? If that has been your life for so many years, how do you redirect yourself? What do you do?
Well, I grieved for quite a long time. I did try to get into something else. I did a couple of crossing with John in Australia, and our little dog Serafine.
I remember it.
Yeah, and I went to Antarctica and did the last degree to the South Pole, thinking, oh, I want to do a new route in Antarctica. But it was all really half-hearted. And then John and I ended up divorcing. And that became a big expedition. It's something that takes a lot of energy. And eventually I realized that I didn't need to push myself physically anymore to grow. And I just went along with the flow. I got into art in a big way. I did a lot of painting and drawing. Mm-hmm. And then I fell in love with a village in Nepal. I was teaching people high altitude climbing, because there's nothing better than to share what you know when you know it's going to help people achieve their dreams. Mm. I've always loved that, and I still love it, even though I don't teach people high altitude climbing anymore. Now I take them to a village that has changed my life, and that was through a Nepali Tamang person who was working on a trip with me, teaching those people to climb, like Patamang from Lura in the Sulu area. That's the region just below the Everest region. Mm-hmm. He invited me to go and stay with his family in this small village of subsistence farmers. And my life changed forever. I started to realize that personal goals are very important as long as you need them. But then opening yourself up to a common goal, which is being part of a community and helping people and feeling the love in giving and receiving, is extraordinary. So I've had a connection with Lura since I first went there in 2007. I've been filming. I'm still grappling with making a documentary out of all the footage that I have. And I've been going there with groups, doing community treks, and I've got a yoga trek coming up. Well, it was supposed to be this year, but I think it's going to be next year now.
I think there's not much hope of it this year. So when you say helping the community, what are you doing? What type of work are you doing there?
It all depends what they want, basically, because I don't believe in the colonial approach of we know what's
imposing.
Good for you.
Yes.
So it was a question of asking them. And they wanted to learn to read and write. This is the woman of the village, because, I mean, they're the one who look after the land. And I always thought, well, you are so important, women. You're the ones at home. I mean, the men are out, you know, trying to earn money, whether it's in the Middle East or on treks. And you're the one who look after the place and the children and everything. And you don't have an education. You don't know how to read or write in your own language. And to me, to be able to process information available, that was the first step. And they were keen to learn to read and write. So I fundraised through my website, and they had the full learning with locals, because once again, it's about empowering locals and women. Yeah. So local trainers were trained to help them, and then they did empowerment courses. And now each time I've gone back, because it seems absolutely impossible to communicate wishes when you're not there. It doesn't matter if you've got internet, telephone or anything. It's like you've got to be there and ask the questions
face
yourself.
Face to face.
This is Nepal. And that's the beauty of it. You know, you don't know what's going to happen, and you go with the flow, and something always happens. It's gorgeous.
I think that's the thing, you do have to let yourself go with the flow, don't you?
You can't go in with
a sort of a rigid approach. It just won't work.
This is not a school class. You know, it's the real world, and you have to flow with it. Yeah. And of course, taking groups, it's not always easy, because people expect to have whatever the expectations are met, and I always try to do my best with that. And sometimes it's just a question of just relaxing and enjoying being there.
Modifying expectations,
To suit
the environment. Definitely.
That's right, And so in the latest trips I've taken there, we've helped with getting water to the forestry group's place so they can grow trees. They build a community center because the women wanted a place to meet. It's gone to a bit of a stop now. We were looking into health as one of the next aims, but since COVID-19 has entered the scene, I'm not sure when I'm going to be there next. And you know, it's more about feeding people right now. So I've been thinking about perhaps starting a fundraising to help feed the families of Lura. Of course, they can grow their own food, but you can't grow everything. You can't grow rice there or oil and, you know, all those things that are needed to have a reasonably balanced diet.
Yep, definitely. When you're not there and you're at home, you live in Victoria still, don't you? Mm-hmm. How connected are you to your local community, given that community is, you know, pretty important part of life for people?
Well, I think that spending time in Lura really opened my eyes to the fact that Nadimark is not just a base camp for me, it's also a very special community. And the simple way to become part of a community is to volunteer. So that's what I've been doing. I started with volunteering with the Nadimark Community Energy Group. But my idea was to meet new people, and somehow all the people who were involved with that organisation I already knew. So I was like, let's start again.
Passionate about the same thing.
Yeah. And lots of climbers. And I wanted to learn more about the other people in the community, because there's a story to every one of us. And I'm very curious about hearing it and to see what people have learned in their life. And so I joined the Rapalese Historical Society, and I've been happily ensconced there for the last 2 years, using my training as an ABC radio producer to do podcasts and interviews with all the people in the community and to collect their stories.
Fantastic. So if people who are listening today wanted to hear you, how would they find those podcasts?
Well, I've put everything on my Patreon page, which is patreon.com/forwardbrigittemuir. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of podcasts there, and also write a blog and share stories with people, whether it's about what happens in my life and what I call the adventures in life, because it's, you know, you don't have to be on an expedition to a faraway land to have an adventure. You can have it in everyday life. It just depends on the way you look at things.
Well, that was actually going to be my sort of closing question to you. If someone wants to have an adventurous life, again, it doesn't have to be big mountains. Is it more a mindset of you know, setting a goal and working towards it and achieving it, do you think?
Yeah, well, it depends where you are at in your life. I think it's about getting out of your comfort zone, whatever that may be. Mm. And it's for each of us to decide what that is and what the opportunities around are. And we are surrounded by opportunities. We just have to open our eyes and our heart to them.
Well, it has been a wonderful, wonderful surprise talking to you today. And I want to thank you so much for sharing those chapters of your life. And hopefully we can catch up again and hear more about what you've been doing.
Thank you. Thank you. And also, I would like to mention that I am married again to a non-climber. A beautiful man called Eric from New Orleans, of all places.
Oh.
And he is really helping me grow.
And obviously he's very understanding of the tent situation.
He is, yep.
He is. All right, well, again, thank you so much for joining us today, and hopefully we'll catch up again with you soon.
Thank you, Liz.
That's it for today's episode of Talking Australia. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to reach out. Write us an email, podcast@australiangeographic.com, or find us on Instagram at Australian Geographic. And if you go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia, you'll find a special subscription offer. So don't wait. Go to australiangeographic.com.au/talkingaustralia. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from. Thanks for listening, and hear you next time.